Before I start, I just want to acknowledge my co-authors of this work, Margaret Thorne, Jennifer Hart, and Marcus Kleber, Sarah Byrne, and my PhD advisor, John Hart. I'm going to really try not to let this cold interfere. There's three kind of main messages that I hope will permeate throughout the talk, and that basically is that within watershed distribution of organic matter, short-range transport has important implications for dynamics of organic matter, and that the overall stability and mechanisms of stabilization of organic matter are dependent on what type of erosional processes are active in such dynamic landscapes and the nature of the depositional environments. Our work indicates that the positional positions are effective in not just storage, but also stabilization of organic matter, and that physical and chemical mechanisms appear to be effective in poorly drained, lower-lying depositional positions when compared to well-aerated depositional positions that are higher up on the slope. But I'll also make a point later on to indicate that because of the high rate of MPP in some of these lower-lying depositional positions, looking at just a single indicator of stability might lead to some misleading results. So, as we all know, terrestrial biosphere is dominated by dynamic landscapes where biogeochemical processes are controlled by interaction of different geomorphic, pedogenic, and ecological processes that shape them. Simply put, what this figure is illustrating is that the amount of organic matter that we would have at different locations within this ideal toposequence is regulated differently, slightly differently in different portions of it, and that on the top in the eroding positions, we have two large fluxes as usual that we look at, input from NPP and loss through decomposition. But in eroding landscapes, obviously there's a significant loss term associated with erosion that needs to be considered, and then that loss term in the hill slopes is an input term into the depositional environments, obviously, and there's cycling of both the deposited organic matter and in situ produced organic matter in the lower lying depositional positions. Several people, including myself, have used a slightly modified version of Yanni's model to study dynamics of organic matter storage, especially in such landscapes. And basically what we have is two loss terms instead of one with oxidation and one for erosion in these type of systems. And these are, perfectly useful techniques when we're trying to determine carbon stocks at different positions, but obviously tell us very little about the nature or fate of organic matter in such systems. So this disconnect in the setting of the terrestrial biosphere, the dominance of dynamic landscapes versus the how we study natural conditions, so that a lot of what we understand about mechanisms of stabilization being derived from relatively static landscapes has some important disconnect that we need some explicit considerations when looking at dynamic hill slopes, and specifically, we need to put into consideration that there could be changes in the rate of organic matter decomposition that are associated with, first of all, detachment of aggregates that could arise, for example, by kinetic energy of raindrops, or as things are moving down along hill slopes, so transport-induced, or even changes in organic matter decomposition after that material is deposited somewhere downhill. And so we can't infer basically that the same stability and stabilization mechanisms are dominating in the eroding slope positions versus the depositional positions. And as I indicated earlier, we also need to take into consideration this high rate of plant productivity in some of these downslope depositional environments, because remember that relatively nutrient-rich topsoil material from the slopes is ending up there, and as long as there's enough water, not too much water, then there's high productivity. So my previous work and others had we spend a lot of time verifying that erosion actually constitutes a sink term in the terrestrial carbon balance. So the next step we took in our work was trying to understand the long-term sequestration potential in these systems. Yes, we can store organic matter, it seems like, in eroding landscapes, but what is the stability and stabilization mechanisms? Because those obviously would determine what would happen to this organic matter in the long term. So we looked at three classes of stabilization mechanisms, physical, chemical, and also trying to infer the molecular architecture of organic matter. To start with, we adopted, traditionally accepted definitions of stability as, obviously protection of organic matter from loss, and we assumed this would be indicated by increasing mean residence time of organic matter in the depositional versus eroding positions. As you'll see, that's not as easy as that. And we considered the fact that erosion can play different roles that could affect stability of organic matter in such dynamic hill slopes. First of all, we could have loss of fairly labile components of organic matter both during detachment or transport phases of erosion. And also acknowledge that erosion is actually about the only way that mineral-associated, relatively more stable organic matter can be relocated in large quantities, and that the decomposition rate of this mineral-associated organic matter, be it physically or chemically associated with mineral organic matter, can be changed during or after transport. So these are just some simple cartoons to illustrate our point that above or below ground organic matter, once it enters the soil, obviously can exist as free organic matter, what we call as free light fraction in the fractionation scheme that we followed, or it could be physically isolated inside aggregates, chemically obviously bonded with minerals, or that the nature of its composition would render it slightly less decomposable. So how do these things come into play in eroding landscapes? In the next couple of slides, I will try to basically go over some conceptual reasoning that went into our work at how these different stabilization mechanisms would work in eroding systems. As in static landscapes, also in dynamic hill slopes, the physical isolation is accomplished, obviously, by encapsulation of organic matter inside aggregates and or barrier, and the limiting accessibility to decomposers and restricted rate of self-diffusion enzymes or other products of extracellular synthesis reactions or change in microclimatic conditions at that scale would render organic matter, can render it less decomposable. And we believe erosion can lead to either increase or decrease of organic matter that's stabilized in this way. It could increase it, obviously, if you have detachment or aggregates breaking down and fairly labile organic matter that was previously physically stabilized, obviously now becoming accessible, or some change in microclimatic conditions at that scale could also render it more decomposable, can decompose it even faster. But on the flip side, you could also have more aggregation and even burial in deeper soil layers that can increase the stability of this pool of organic matter. And this is entirely possible when you take into consideration that some of these depositional environments have higher bulk density, higher proportion of finer particles, higher water content, and it is also likely that organic matter that was previously associated with fairly coarse particles that didn't provide a lot of stabilizing surface area for organic matter, once it's transported and deposited further downslope, it can find itself in what we call this new matrix context, where it now is in vicinity of reactive minerals where that can provide stabilization for these organic matter. Obviously, the net effect of erosion on organic matter that's stabilized physically would depend on the duration of the exposure, the transport phases, how deep is it buried, and what kind of newly created matrix context it might find itself in. Also, as I indicated, it's in the chemical stabilization obviously would also be possible by association with soil minerals through a variety of bonding mechanisms. We believe it's entirely possible that erosion can lead to reduced rate of decomposition of organic matter that's stabilized in this way if as I indicated a second ago, if organic matter finds itself in this new matrix context, new potential for stabilization that didn't have in the slopes, and it's also possible that once in this environment, it could form energetically stronger inner sphere complex bonds in this environment. So far, we haven't found any evidence that organic matter could, erosion can break if these energetically stable, stronger inner sphere bonds are formed, erosion can break them. So it's really unlikely that during transport or detachment, erosion can increase the rate of decomposition of this pool of organic matter. The only way it would be possible, as I had said, with the physical stabilization, is if the microclimatic conditions change enough and organic matter finds itself in, you know, ample availability of nutrients for the decomposers and optimum microclimatic conditions in the depositional environment, then yes, it's possible that it could be decomposed. And the molecular architecture can play a role in stabilization, partly because you know, this composition of organic matter, the structural composition, can some compounds are obviously so they're different to decompose than others. But it's important to remember that this is an inherent molecular property. It's independent of location and so or transport. So it's not really a, it's not likely to play as big of a role in stabilization. It is indeed possible that erosion can lead to redistribution, and during that redistribution, we can have some selective preservation of organic functional groups that are likely to survive exposure to oxidizing near-surface environment, for example, such as, you know, the nonpolar compounds, lipid-like compounds, or molecules that are a little larger than others. So they can be selectively preserved. But it's important to note here that they are not stabilized during erosion. They're just selectively preserved during this process. So we tried to make a distinction. And so, so in the rest of the talk, I'll present some results that compare eroding and depositional landform positions in one eroding topo sequence in terms of how much organic matter is there, how effective are these landform positions for stabilization, and also results from three classes of stabilization mechanisms that I indicated by a combination of results that are derived from density fractionation, selective extractions for iron aluminum, and NMR. Okay, so all the work that I'm going to be talking about today was conducted in the northern part of California in the marine headlands, an area that's underlain by Franciscan sandstone paramaterial. The soils and the slopes were characterized as enthesols. They are very rocky, shallow, relatively, although they differ in depth as you go down the hill slope. And with very little evidence of horizonation, those on the depositional end, the two positions were characterized as mollisols. So I wanted to indicate that I will talk about two groups of eroding positions. The area that's on top around summit and shoulder, I'll just call it summit for convenience here, but it represents the area that's summit and shoulder, and that slope term represents the area that's in the back slope position. And then the two depositional positions that I'll talk about in this watershed are these hollow, which is a terrestrial depression, a landslide scar that was created about 13,000 years ago, and this downslope alluvial colluvial plain. The main mode of transport for organic matter and soil and associated organic matter in this case is diffusive transport of burrowed material. So gophers are very active in this landscape. They burrow material out, and it's just moved down mainly by the due to gravity. There's very little erosion that also happens with rain splash, but it's relatively small. Previous work that was done in this site had indicated that about two-thirds of the soil that's eroded from both of these eroding positions found itself in these two depositional environments in this watershed. And similarly, for carbon, anywhere from half to two-thirds of that of the carbon is deposited, is captured in the two depositional positions. I won't go through this in detail, but just to give you an idea that we followed Solins and Goltzian's technique for density fractionation. We isolated the free light fraction of what floated basically when we added the SPT solution to the soil. Then we isolated the occluded light fraction as the fraction that was liberated after we mixed it and sonicated the soil. And then the remaining residue is the dense fraction that constitutes the chemically associated fraction. And we also did three selective extractions with daphnite, oxalate, and pyrophosphate that I'll be talking about. And then we did NMR to infer information about the biochemical composition of organic matter, and especially also change associated with the transformation of the organic matter composition during decomposition. Simply put, we're just using Baldock's technique and using the alkyl to O-alkyl ratio, basically the ratio of the alkyls, the saturated aliphatics that show up in the 0 to 50 ppm portion of the spectra, the lipids, saturated aliphatics, so lipids, waxes, and the like, to the ratio of the relatively easy to decompose components, the simple carbohydrates, sugars, the O, and substituted alkyls that show up in the 50 to 110 ppm of that spectrum. So this is the data from the bulk soil, no fractionation, without any pretreatment. In all the slides that I'll be talking about, I'll use the same symbols. The circles are the eroding positions. The triangles are the depositional ones. And as you notice, obviously, that there's a large stock of carbon. We have, as I'll show you in a second, we have a large stock of carbon in the depositional environments, but as this highlights, especially in the top soil positions, that's not really necessarily because they have everywhere higher percent carbon, but we have a much deeper soils to work with in the depositional environments. We also have high carbon to nitrogen ratio on top that decreases with depth everywhere except in the plain. The radiocarbon concentration is given for all of them. It will be on that side. if we put together the radiocarbon information and the carbon inventory, first you have the inventory of carbon in the same symbols apply, by the way, that you had here everywhere. So if you look at the carbon inventory, we have the solid line. We have a much higher carbon inventory in the depositional environments, as I indicated. This is the fraction, the weighed fraction modern value, which is basically indicating that the lower this number is, the more old organic matter you have. So this is trying to differentiate between sites that have a lot of young organic matter versus a lot of old organic matter, because storing a lot of new organic matter obviously wouldn't make it means it's not being very effective in storage of that organic matter. It's just cycling it through faster. So the lower this value, the more effective it is in storage. And so if you look at this, you also indicate that the two depositional basins, the two depositional landform positions, indeed are storing a lot more old carbon. And then if we look at the NMR results, we notice that there's actually organic matter that appears to be less decomposed, less processed at depth, especially the eroding positions, the two circles down here. But overall, we notice very small change in that alkyl to alkyl ratio with depth in the depositional environments that actually is consistent. It's in the fractions, as I'm going to show you, indicating that there's at least some significant preservation of organic matter without transformation in chemical composition. And so finding of fairly young or less processed, at least organic matter, was verified by a radiocarbon-based estimates that we did of how much organic matter from deep soils is actually cycling through on an annual time scale. So how much does it contribute, offset the input of organic matter to the soil organic matter pool? So this axis here is showing values for percent of I input to the soil organic matter put. So this is not MPP. This is rather input to the actual soil pool of organic matter. The whole method of how this was calculated was published in 2008. I won't go in detail. But the idea here is basically that this is the inventory. The dotted line is showing the carbon inventory that is below 30 centimeters. Keep in mind, as I mentioned before, that this is a site that has active bioturbation, so there's a lot more mixing in the 0 to 30 centimeters. So this is below the mixed layer in the subsoil. This is the talking about basically the stock below 30 centimeters, and this is the contribution of that deep organic matter to offsetting annual input of organic matter to the soil pool, basically indicating that there's a lot more active exchange happening in the lower positions. And you don't have to worry about how busy this slide is because we're not going to go through everything. I have also taken out all the values that are not significant. I'm just going to highlight a few things that we learned here, and that is that the cation bridging, as indicated by association of bulk carbon, total carbon, with cation exchange capacity in soil, seems to be effective for accumulation of organic matter, but not necessarily accumulation only in the summit, and important for its stability in all the positions other than the plain. And we also notice there's a strong association of minerals with stability in the depositional positions. So if you compare the values that would be in this versus that's what you're getting in this area versus that area. And you also have a storage and stability in the slope as related to only specific surface area and cation bridging, but nothing else in the slopes. So this all the empty spots. And if we went further and looked at the fraction that is not as protected in any way by the minerals, we notice it's a very small fraction, but in the slopes, it's old and appears to be relatively highly processed. In the depositional environment, it's also old, but appears less transformed, probably suggesting there's physical protection of soil organic matter by burial in the deep soil layers in the depositional positions. And if we look at the physically isolated or occluded fraction, it constitutes a much higher fraction of organic matter total. And what we see is that the occluded light fraction in deep soil layers appears to be less processed, but it is still radiometrically older than that are near the soil surfaces. And we also observe that less transformation of soil organic matter as we go with depth in this figure. Okay. So similar table, a lot more empty spots, indicating that the amount of organic matter protected inside soil aggregates is related with crystalline iron in the summit, complexation with aluminum in the hollow, and then we have the stronger linear association of minerals with stability of the occluded light fraction only in the depositional positions, not on the eroding. And if we did the same things again for the chemically associated dense fraction, where most of our organic matter actually is in these soils, we observe very small differences between the 14C composition of deep versus near surface soil layers. This is very different than what I had showed you for the occluded light fraction, where there was much separation between deep and surface layers. And we also noticed that chemically protected organic matter in deep soil layers is less processed than that in the surface, and maybe some evidence of the dilution of the pool at depth, actually. And in the depositional plane, again, this fairly straight trend suggesting effective preservation with little structural transformation of that organic matter. Same table again, a similar table except this time for that dense fraction, tells us that complexation is important for storage, and a lot more important for storage than stabilization in summit. This is also supported by a slide that's coming up in the next page. But anyway, there seems to be a significant amount of storage and stability that's in the depositional environment, especially the plane, that's favored by accumulation, first of all, of the oxides and the organic matter. This is what I meant by that, and that is if you look at the inventory of the oxides extracted by the different techniques, the crystalline, poorly crystalline, and then the complex fraction, you notice that as you go down, basically along this this axis, the eroding positions and the depositional positions, in all cases, there's a lot more iron and aluminum extracted in the depositional environments. And what we notice is that if you just computed the ratio of the oxalate versus the diatonite extractable fraction, the two positions that at least in the top have a higher proportion of their iron in poorly crystalline forms seems to actually favor complexation of organic matter and protection of organic matter in this way, especially aromatics. Once we look at, although we're not going to do it here, but if we look at the NMR data in depth, we notice that this is especially the case for aromatic functional groups. And so this is the same plot that I showed you in the last page, a lot more organic inventory of the pyrophosphate extractable iron and aluminum. And if we just followed the techniques of Masiello and Oates, I won't go into the detail, but these are the assumptions, and assume that if we have a ratio of carbon to pyrophosphate extractable iron that's between 2 and 10, that all available organic carbon in that position is bound to metals through organomineral chelation, then we notice that, indeed, we do have that potential pretty much everywhere except the top layer of the summit. So this doesn't seem to be an effective mechanism in the summit, but everywhere else it seems to fulfill that criteria. But as I mentioned earlier, I think we really need to be careful of how we interpret stability, especially in such dynamic landscapes, because if we had just went ahead and looked at radiocarbon signature only for our organic matter, we would have assumed there's maybe some stabilization, but largely destabilization happening of organic matter in these watersheds, because we had very little or no increase in min residence time in the depositional environments compared to the eroding positions where the organic matter is eroded from. But we had all the right conditions for stability in the depositional environments. We had ample availability of surface area provided by these reactive minerals, especially iron and aluminum oxides. We have stronger physical protection both by aggregation and burial. So what we think likely is happening is that the pool of organic matter obviously is diluted, that signature of that pool is diluted because of that high rate of MPP. But at the same time, there's stabilization happening of some organic matter, both through physical and chemical mechanisms, but decomposition also proceeds. Some new, some old organic matter is also being processed. So we think we got a good picture of what's happening in terms of organic matter dynamics in this system by combining different techniques, and conclude that indeed, our results did confirm that there's significant storage and storage effectiveness of organic matter in the depositional settings. And we provided evidence that soil organic matter in depositional settings is indeed less transformed, better preserved than if it had stayed in those eroding positions that the soil came from. But the effectiveness of the different stabilization mechanisms that we studied depended on the nature of the positions themselves. So within this very relatively small area, so the vertical distance of only about 200 meters, we noticed some really significant differences in what mechanisms are actually effective in stabilizing organic matter. And as we saw, effective physical and chemical stabilization of organic matter in the more significant in the poorly drained, lowest lying plain compared to even the well aerated hollow that was on top. So the nature of that dose position seemed to have a very strong control. And I would not like to conclude without thanking several people that have provided help, especially past and previous members of the members of the Hart Lab at UC Berkeley, the Torn Lab at LBL, and Jennifer Harden's lab at USGS, and funding that was generously provided by these organizations. Thank you.
already bonded to mineral surfaces, right? But you're saying that its stability is increased through bonding to mineral surfaces.
No, what I said was, at least what I implied, I don't know if it came out of it, is that once you transport materials, especially the longer you go, the finer the particles that make it, right? The coarser particles are maybe deposited earlier on in that erosion process. So that what make it actually all the way further are the finer particles, where you would have a higher proportion of those reactive minerals. So, but organic matter, if it's free especially, now is relocated and now associated with finer particles in that deposited material.
So you're talking about particulate organics and...
versus, and the minerals that make it down. Exactly.
So what influence do you think that moisture, soil moisture conditions have on your distribution of your iron oxides? Like soil moisture conditions controlling crystallization as opposed to... so the distribution across the landscape of the iron oxides. So how does how do you think that landscape position is controlling or influencing the distribution of iron oxides?
So I mainly focus on the lateral redistribution part of it, and mainly actually that's what I described based on diffusive transport. It doesn't really have much to do with water, but obviously there's water moving laterally and vertically in these soil profiles, which in an unrelated study to this we have seen actually influences oxide distribution, especially distribution of the polycrystalline ones, significantly, where you end up moving it down based on the profile in a rainfall manipulation experiment, for example, that we did. So that's definitely happening.
Can you assume that all the deposition in the plain, soil in the plain, was from erosion from upslope as opposed to deposition from the stream that you had portrayed in your diagram?
No, I actually don't assume that. We just stayed away from the stream to make sure that we're not significantly capturing the input from the stream versus from the slopes.
What is the flood return interval on that stream?
The flood interval, is that what you asked? So there's a significant amount of material that's moved in the stream, but the overbank flow part of it is probably in the order of 100-year flood events. But there's been an extensive amount of geomorphological work done in this site before my time in there, and we use some of the information that they gained from studies to basically stay as much as possible away from the banks of that creek and more closer to the slopes, where a significant proportion of that soil in the plain would have derived from the slopes. This was actually verified by work that Bill Dittrich and Arjun Hainsath had done in this site, where they worked with an assumption that landslide event that happened 13,000 years ago, that stripped that hollow clean, might have actually moved a lot of the material that was in the plain in the area around the slope too, and their numerical findings agree with that assumption, and so it was a reasonable assumption to make. Although we're not claiming there are absolutely no input, that's probably far fetched, but it's a reasonable assumption to make for the sake of these calculations.
I think one more question.
A quick question. Your erosion rates are very low. They're sort of 10 times lower than in Brooklyn. Do you think it might have an influence on
the... Yeah, because as I mentioned, this is very thickly covered with animal vegetation. I'm glad you asked that question. And the only reason there's a lot of transport happening here is because of that activity of the gophers that are removing the material, and it's on slope, and it's just gravity-driven transport. Actually, Bill Dittrich in the past had tried to simulate water erosion in these sites, and you get very little that way. This is fairly thickly covered vegetation, with animals vegetation especially, and some perennials. So it's very, very low compared to croplands. But we didn't do all the stabilization mechanism work on it, but in a previous work that was related to this, we actually compared, we were interested in trying to see whether erosion induces a sink term in systems that erode differently. And we find that in this system, as well as croplands that we looked at, everywhere erosion seems to have a positive sink associated with it. And so, but this is definitely different than croplands. I wouldn't compare it to.
Okay, great. Thank you.